From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Reverend Jesse Jackson continues to apologize for comments he made about Barack Obama. And after their girls joined Senator and Mrs. Obama for an interview with Access Hollywood, the senator says he won't put his kids in the media spotlight again. So why does he have regrets? For more, we have Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page and radio talk show host Troy Johnson of The Troy Johnson Show in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, gentlemen.
Hello, Farai.
So on Wednesday, Troy, Reverend Jesse Jackson made big headlines for comments he made about Barack Obama. He thought the microphone was turned off, and he whispered that, quote, Barack's been talking down to black people, and continued with a crude anatomical comment. Yesterday, we played an interview we did with Jackson right as the tape was becoming public. Here's a little bit about what he said.
I do not want a sound bite out of context to interrupt a broader conversation, a very positive message he has going to our nation. When I said that some of the messages aimed at the black church could be considered talking down the blacks, my appeal really was the moral content of the message, to not only deal with the personal and moral responsibility of black males, but to deal with the collective moral responsibility of government and the public policy.
Troy, you're in my hometown of Baltimore. I never get tired of saying that. What are folks saying to you on your show? I mean, how are people reacting? How do they see these comments by the Reverend? And do they hold Senator Obama responsible for perhaps pandering to interests outside of the black community?
I think, you know, you want when a situation like this happens, you definitely want to analyze, well, OK, what did Jesse Jackson say within that soundbite? But I think, you know, let's put the context up first. I think he was kind of trash talking off mic, which I was on mic, which you never, ever, ever, if you're out there listening, please make sure the microphone is off before you make some crazy statements.
Walk away from the microphone. That's my advice.
There's plenty of room away from a microphone. I think what Jesse was doing is kind of like the old guard civil rights movement, African-American leadership, and Barack Obama as the new young upstart kid. I think there's a sense of letting him know, hey, you need to keep these things in check. And we're stewarding you through this situation. And that's not really the case. You know, Barack Obama has gone further and farther than even a Jesse Jackson as a presidential candidate. So we're on new terra firma.
Let me get Clarence in here.
Yeah.
Clarence, you know, Jackson's comments were caught during this break on a show called Fox and Friends, and then they were played Wednesday on the O'Reilly Factor. Later in an interview with you, Bill O'Reilly revealed that Fox had more of Jackson's comments on tape, and the network said the rest of the comments were even worse. So do you have any idea what else Reverend Jackson said, and if Fox is going to eventually play it, and if so, when?
No, I don't. In fact, I wasn't even given a transcript of the exact remarks before we went on the air, contrary to what O'Reilly said. They were playing their cards so close to the vest. Frankly, I think if they had anything hotter than what they aired, they would be airing it now. O'Reilly's an old-time journalist before he became a Fox superstar. And, you know, you go with the best stuff you've got. So I personally don't think they've got anything else that matches his cutting remarks, as one of our Tribune headlines put it.
Clarence first, and then Troy. What does this say about the dialogue about black discourse in America? What I mean by that is we're all journalists and folks who are in the media, and there are always many media worlds. There's the sort of inside baseball political world of, you know, people who talk about politics. There's general news. There's black-oriented news. And at this point, what I've noticed is that a lot of African-American discourse is leaking over, understandably, into general media. Do people really kind of really understand in a general audience, Clarence? Do you think people who are not black and who are not kind of generally plugged into black issues, Do they understand kind of the power struggle that's going on here? Or?
No, I don't think they do, and I think they're learning. And I don't think black folks have really come to grips with it because we didn't have to. As my good friend Jack White wrote in TheRoot.com, we now have the prospect of actually being able to fix this mess rather than just complain about it after years, meaning to actually make change in America. You know, you have an African-American in the White House who came from the streets and knows of these problems. That's a whole different debate than what we've had in the past. So I think, we in the black community have been very tolerant and very supportive of our leaders, old and new. It's the media eye that is focused on one leader at a time, and I think that really rankles Reverend Jackson. He's not used to being out of the spotlight.
Troy, do you think that this is a case of ego, or is this a case where Reverend Jackson has made some legitimate points, perhaps not in the most diplomatic way?
I think this is I think there's a bit of an ego bruising. I think it's interesting. Jesse Jackson claims to have, you know, thrown his support behind the Obama campaign, but I think he did it with a discerning eye. I think he did it at some distance for some time now. And I think that, you know, they've obviously crossed paths long before Senator Obama was pushed to the forefront of politics in this election cycle. But I think, you know, the point about, you know, responsibility with black fathers and in the community is I think Obama's comments were similar to what Bill Cosby had to say. And I don't really think that Jesse's point in that regard, I don't think that Obama was talking down to black people. I think he was pointing out something that's been pointed out by many other people. It's not what we want to hear all the time, but it's the truth.
Before we leave this topic and move on, I'm just curious at this point, just briefly, give me a sense of how this election rates and ranks, Clarence, in terms of the most fun you've had covering an election and the most unexpected twists and turns.
Well, I got into this business as a teenager in the early 60s because I want to be an eyewitness to history. And this is the kind of thing I've been living for. You know, back in the early 60s, we saw the change that TV was beginning to make. Now today, we see a real national conversation happening on race. And that means all of this this stuff, these gaffes, these various Sister Soldier episodes, et cetera, are being played out in this national conversation of the media, including this radio network and all the other media that we have. And I think I see a social change going on similar to that which happened in the 60s, and I hope to be able to witness as much of it as I can.
Troy?
I am so excited I can't stand it. I think it's quite interesting. I remember being a young kid watching Ronald Reagan campaign. I think it was probably the Republican National Convention. And I was excited, not that I'm a Republican, but I happen to be excited about the process, and I have been ever since. This is probably the longest presidential election cycle that we've had. I think people are more engaged than they ever have been. And we've got a lot of work to do when you think about only, you know, roughly half of the American population votes. There are a lot of people that are plugged in, but there's still a lot of people that aren't. And I'm hoping that we get to the point where we do have a general sense that everybody is engaged in the process. And I think we'll have a better government and we'll elect the right people.
I'm going to move on to another political topic. Over the holiday weekend, Obama's daughters, Malia and Sasha, ages 10 and 7, slipped into the media spotlight with an interview with Access Hollywood.
This is what you do, Daddy. You,
uh-oh.
When you, it's not that bad,
I'll
but when
it.
You come home, you know, you have your big, gigantic bag and you leave it in the mudroom. Sometimes I trip over it.
Yeah, you leave
yeah,
your bag.
I do trip
yeah,
over
yeah.
everything,
right,
and it's heavy.
Pile on Daddy. Anyway, shortly afterwards, Obama said he regretted letting his daughters be interviewed. Let's take a quick listen to him on the Today Show with Matt Lauer.
I think that we got carried away in the moment. We were having a birthday party and everybody was laughing and suddenly this thing cropped up and I didn't catch it quickly enough. And I was surprised by the attention it received.
So if you had
well.
To do so, it over again?
Yeah, we wouldn't do it again and we won't be doing it again.
Is that a smart move, Clarence? I mean, you know, it's like there's nothing cuter than little kids, and their kids are awfully cute. So is it good to say we're not going to bring them back on? And why would he even have regrets?
there's two levels here of a response. For one, as a father, I've learned from Obama, never let my family on national TV have a chance before I could shut any of them up to put all of our business in the street, right? Number two, we've seen many candidates. Kids are really a special thing with political candidates. We don't have time to do all the anecdotes, but look what happened with Chelsea Clinton. This year, for the first time, she spoke in public, and even when she was campaigning with or for her mom, she wouldn't talk to the press, and that got kind of awkward. But this is how protective families can be of their kids, even a fully grown kid like Chelsea Clinton. I think this is an area of privacy that candidates are best left to keep, and I think the public goes along with that.
Troy, do you think it's a good move that Senator Obama had the kids show their adorableness and then says no more, or should he use them relentlessly from a campaign perspective, quickly?
I think it was a good move. I think there are a lot of people that that claim they don't really know who Barack Obama is. I think this helps solidify him as a family man and understand, the people that are in his general space. But I understand his trepidation taken out of context, and I don't think anybody would want that to happen.
All right. Well, gentlemen, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Clarence Page is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and he joined us from the NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Troy Johnson is a radio talk show host in Baltimore, Maryland, and he joined us from the studios at the Baltimore Sun. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You cannot do a jazz series without this sound. It's music from the Dirty Dozen, one of a number of famous brass bands that helped give the city of New Orleans its voice. But what is New Orleans jazz? How is it faring since Hurricane Katrina sent the city's musicians to higher ground? Well, we've got three musicians who help make up the heart and soul of the city with us. Irvin Mayfield is a trumpeter, composer, band leader, and cultural ambassador of New Orleans. Irma Thomas is known as the Queen of New Orleans Soul, but that soul is linked to New Orleans jazz. And Greg Davis is a trumpeter and a founder of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, one of the city's longtime ensembles. Folks, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Glad to be here.
And doing great. So, Greg, let me start with you. We are hearing a very distinct sound from your band, the Dirty Dozen. Explain for folks who don't know what kind of music you play.
Well, first of all, it's music, and I think the fact that we're here in New Orleans, started out the band here in New Orleans, grew up in New Orleans, it's New Orleans music. Even when we were taking bits and pieces from other forms of music, it all ends up being New Orleans music, which for us, I think the main thing that we wanted to make sure happened with the music is that people could dance and move to the music.
But give me just a tiny little bit of history on how these brass bands developed.
Well, the history of brass bands as a brass band goes way, way back to the French military style of having bands and doing funerals and all that, way, way back. But as far as the bands as they are now, the Dirty Dozen imitated what had been done with the brass bands that existed in the 40s, 50s, and 60s here in New Orleans, where they played, developed music from the church hymns and then took that on into, secular music. For the Dirty Dozen, the history goes, we intended to imitate what was happening with brass bands just before the Dirty Dozen, but we weren't getting any work. But we had gotten to the habit of rehearsing 5-6 hours a night, and this would have been in the mid-70s. And in doing those rehearsals, we found that, okay, we're not getting any work, so let's experiment with some other music. The other music then happened to be so-called modern jazz, R&B. I mean, we would, at rehearsals, we'd rehearse some Charlie Parker and then some Marvin Gaye or some James Brown or whatever, you know. And then when we would get a gig, we'd play what we had rehearsed.
Irma, you are one of those people who also has a very broad sense of what music is. You have an album coming out. It's called Simply Grand, and let's listen to a little bit of This Bitter Earth.
This bitter earth it can be so cold. Today you're young, too soon you're old.
Now, you can't help but think when you hear a song like this, a classic song like this, you can't help but think of what New Orleans has been through. And I have been blessed to have been to New Orleans many times, including reporting on Katrina, but also just to enjoy your culture. What happened to you as a person and as a musician during the whole Katrina event and aftermath?
Well, I was blessed that the only gig I had in the month of August took me out of the city. I had one gig scheduled for that month. It was that day, that Saturday, at the end of August, and I was in Austin, Texas. And we had flown to Austin to do the gig, and of course we had only packed enough belongings to last a couple of nights. And unfortunately, we were not able to return. We didn't get back to Louisiana until the Wednesday after. So I consider myself blessed in that. You know, if I had been home, I probably would have been actually resting in peace by now, because I would have probably gone to bed and did not wake up from being drowned in the flood. Because normally you stay up all night and you watch the hurricane, and when it's over with, you go to bed and catch up on your sleep. And that's how a lot of folks lost their lives. They were actually asleep when the floods came. So I consider myself blessed, and I was sitting in the hotel in Austin when I was watching the news and discovered that I was among the folk that they were concerned about the whereabouts of, and Fats Domino was the other. And I couldn't wait to get back to Louisiana to call somebody and let them know. But of course, the 504 area code was not working, so I couldn't contact anyone to let them know that I was okay and that I was safe in the Austin, Texas area.
And you ended up losing a nightclub that you'd been running.
Oh, yeah, correct? 24 years the Lion's Den had been operating, and it was like my second living room, and everything went under. The water was actually above the roof at the club. It was up to the roof at our home, but it was over the roof at the club, and we lost everything. It took my husband about 3 or 4 days to go in after he was able to get in to find some of the cash register and some of the other things that he was looking for in the club. Mm-hmm. It was just that bad.
Irvin, we're going to talk quite a bit about your music and all of the different hats you wear, including cultural ambassador of New Orleans. But I'm wondering if you can tell us, and I'm sure it's difficult, about what happened to your father.
Yeah, well, he was a unfortunate victim of Hurricane Katrina. He did drown. He was a victim. And basically, that example that Miss Thomas gave about what happens in a hurricane is generally the case. I mean, people, you know, look, we're used to hurricanes, and most of all in New Orleans, we're used to flooding to the extent that once every 5 or 6 years you get some water in your house, and in 2-3 days it's gone, and you replace your carpet and your furniture. A levee breach is something that just is completely unheard of, and that whole experience was something out of out of what you would hope to be a movie or some fantasy experience, but it wasn't. So my dad was a victim of drowning due to that. And part of the great tragedy was we weren't able to really know about that until months later, until his body was found, which had to be found with DNA samples. And the other thing was we weren't able to give the proper burials because of, you know, that type of situation and bodies not being found for so long. So it was a really unique and very tragic situation, which is very interesting now when you look at a lot of the the catastrophes that have happened in the United States this year, people kind of have an understanding of what we experience in New Orleans, but they don't really get that, you know, when you talk about a town with the type of populations that they're talking about, you really have to multiply it times 100 to understand really what the New Orleans experience was.
Let me play a little bit of In a Sentimental Mood, a bit of your music originally by Duke Ellington. So I understand you're 30 years old, is that correct?
That's right, I'm 30 years old.
Okay, so you are a professor, you work with kids, you have a band, and you're the cultural ambassador of the city of New Orleans. How do you pack that in?
Well, I think really a lot of the stories of the average New Orleanian is that everybody's doing their part. You know, in this town, people have kind of done stories all around the country about the volunteers that we have here, but a lot of the work that we do, I guess we can't really be considered as volunteers because it's our whole city, but it's just an example of everybody doing their part. So whether it's being on a library board or, you know, working with kids or just getting out trying to clean up around your block, I'm not doing anything different than what the average New Orleanian is doing. This is just what's required right now to keep the city moving forward.
Well, just want to let folks know, if anyone has just tuned in the middle of this, we're talking about New Orleans jazz. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and we just were hearing from Irvin Mayfield, a trumpeter, composer, bandleader, and cultural ambassador of New Orleans. Also got Irma Thomas, singer and recording artist, and Greg Davis of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. Greg, let me go to you as a fan. In addition to being a musician, I'm sure you're a fan of other artists. In and from New Orleans. So just rattle off a few, and we'll have this on our website, and we'll list it. But for folks who are looking around for some good music, just throw out a few people for us.
Well, in throwing out a few, you know, I might miss some. But, you know, I've had the pleasure, of course, of working with the Dirty Dozen since 1977. But since then, you know, I booked a jazz at Jazz Fest. Booked stuff at Harris. I teach at Loyola, so I get to interact with all kinds of musicians. I'm sitting here next to Irma. You know, I've known her from way back, even before the Dirty Dozen. I used to do R&B stuff with other bands in the early '70s. I'm 51 now, but I've had the pleasure of also working with Irving. You know, and the stuff that he does. I don't think I could just name some without forgetting, you know, others. But, you know, there's Fats Domino, if he still does some stuff. There's Alan Toussaint. There are a lot of the locals that I like listening to. You know, Walter Washington, I like going out to check out. I mean, there are a lot of people here. There's B.J. Crosby. I mean, just a lot of people. I tell you what, you know, other cities have been sort of crowned as we never close, but you can truly come to New Orleans and always find some good music almost any time of the day or night.
Irma, I want to go into, there's so much to talk about, and as we were here in our offices, like, well, you know, what can we do on New Orleans jazz that doesn't require a 10 CD set? Well, we can't cover it all, but there's some interesting stories, and I want to go to one of them. We know Louis Armstrong belongs to New Orleans, but one of gospel's greatest singers also comes from New Orleans. I'm talking about Mahalia Jackson.
Yes.
She had some interesting, not uncommon thoughts about jazz, though. What were they?
Well, Mahalia was a gospel singer, and she was true to her genre. She did not stray outside of her field, and it comes from her upbringing, such as same as me. We were all raised in the church, and we were taught that you do not sing gospel music in nightclubs. You do not mix the two when you're doing a performance. And I'm one of those folks that don't mix the two. I'm often asked to sing Amazing Grace when I'm doing my R&B set, and I will politely tell them, no, I don't do that. If you want to find me singing gospel, come to 2216 3rd Street at First African Baptist Church. I'm on the second row in the alto section. And she was true to her upbringing. She wanted to sing gospel. She stuck to her guns, and that's all she would do. And she really didn't look down on the jazz scene. She just did not want to be a part of it or associated as being a participant for her living, and that's the way she stood her ground.
And Irving, she did make one important exception, and that was for Duke Ellington. Let's hear a little bit of Mahalia Jackson with Duke Ellington singing Come Sunday. Irving, when you listen to that collaboration, and I'm not going to ask you to put a label on what it is, but what do you hear?
Well, you can ask me what it is. It's jazz. I think to clarify what Ms. Thomas is talking about, she's talking about, first of all, an environment. And when you're talking about European classical music traditions, be it symphony orchestras, and when you're talking about jazz, especially when you're talking about the core of it that Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington have done, you're really talking about a art form of music, and the environment is appropriate. I mean, actually, European classical music was born out of the church, as we know from Bach, and much is the same as jazz music was born out of the church from Louis Armstrong. The brass band songs were all church songs at first. I mean, one of our most famous jazz songs is "Oh, When the Saints Go Marching In." I think what Mahalia Jackson really was saying was that she was a gospel singer. That's what she did. She did not want to be something else because that would not be true. And what Mrs. Thomas is talking about, the appropriate thing at the appropriate time. You know, I wouldn't want to play a symphony piece in the middle of a club either. And I don't want to truncate, spiritual music down to the level of a club or a symphonic piece. But to say that the right environment, the right things have to be put together. And New Orleans is a ceremonial place, and we know about when the appropriate time to do the appropriate thing is. And, Mahalia Jackson was an example of a classic New Orleanian.
Ceremonial place. There have been some battles over the second line and what's the role of music in the New Orleans. Irvin, and I'm going to get each of you to comment just very quickly on this. Do you think that your traditions will continue?
Well, the first thing is, I have a very intimate relationship. I'm on a Police and Justice Foundation with the Chief of Police, Juan Riley, and with the mayor. And we had a press conference that said that no musicians would ever be arrested for playing an instrument. I think what we do have is misconfusion, miscommunication about that. And the city of New Orleans, number one natural resource is its culture. And at the center of that is music, and it is food. So the city cannot continue to be the city without that.
Irma, just quickly, are you confident that you guys can hold on? And for
yes.
John.
Yeah. Yes, we can. Because we, by nature, we are survivors. And our talent is our survival, is part of our survival skills. And we do what we do best, that is bring joy to folks who are at a time in their lives when they need something to break away from the drudgery of trying to reconstruct their lives. And so for no other reason, it will become a strong force into giving people some inspirational hope to continue their lives as we know it here in New Orleans.
Greg?
Yeah. Well, I think I would agree with what both have said. But I do know even before the storm, to be a musician in New Orleans was somewhat of a struggle. You know, we, the Dirty Dozen, we made our living out on the road away from New Orleans, but our hearts and souls were here to live in New Orleans. I've been all over the world. I wouldn't want to live any other place. Uh-huh. So even after the storm, to continue the struggle has always been there, and I think musicians will always survive here.
Well, I want to thank the three of you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right.
We've been speaking with Greg Thomas, founding member of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. Its latest record is an interpretation of Marvin Gaye songs called What's Going On. Irma Thomas is the queen of New Orleans soul. Her forthcoming album is simply grand, and Irving Mayfield is a trumpeter, composer, educator, band leader. His latest record is Love Songs, Ballads, and Standards. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's like Mothra versus Godzilla out there. I'm talking about the monster movie-style battle between tech giants Microsoft and Yahoo. We'll talk through the latest twist on our tech segment today. Plus, we'll dig into news about online photo sharing and privacy issues with YouTube. With us today is Jay Smooth. He video blogs at illdoctrine.com. Hey, Jay.
Hello, hello.
So let's break down the biggest fight in technology. So software giant Microsoft tried to take over rival Yahoo, but walked away from the fight in May when things weren't going well. But on Monday, Microsoft said it still wanted to buy Yahoo's search business or maybe the entire company. There's one condition. Yahoo would have to replace its current board of directors. So what do you make of this whole battle? Boil it down for people who are just like, I have a computer and I use it. I don't have stock. I don't have anything else. What is this all about?
Well, I mean, you have this company, Yahoo, which is, I mean, a very compelling story to me because the man who's running it now, Jerry Yang, is the one who started it as his pet project. You know, it was his Stanford student website to start it out named Jerry's Guide to the World Wide Web, and it's been built into one of the biggest major corporations and sort of maintained its independence for a long time with him at the head. But the business has been in a downward spiral for a number of years now, and people have a lot of doubts about whether the founder, Jerry Yang, can still keep it a healthy business. And I think a lot of the stockholders and shareholders don't share my romantic notions about how cool it is that he's running things. And they'd like to see someone else come in. And Microsoft has been the one that's been trying to step in. But then I think many of the shareholders and certainly Jerry Yang are afraid that Microsoft only wants to use Yahoo as a pawn and doesn't really have its best interests at heart. A lot of people think that Microsoft just wants to use Yahoo as one of its weapons in a future war against Google. So, I think many people feel like they're stuck between a rock and a hard place as far as the future of the company. And then you've got this other sort of corporate raider, Carl Icahn, coming in through the back end trying to take over the board of directors. And now Microsoft is hoping that Carl Icahn can pull that off, and then Microsoft can pull off a deal with Carl Icahn and just push Jerry Yang out the side door.
It really is kind of a lot going on there. But if there is some kind of a hostile takeover, hostile merger type thing, how would that affect our everyday lives, if at all?
That's a good question. I mean, I think for the vast majority of us who just relate to Yahoo as consumers, I mean, Yahoo has been past its prime for a while. You know, it used to be the dominant internet brand, and it's been fading quite a bit since then. I think no matter what is the outcome, Yahoo will still be around, but it'll continue to fade. And I think, you know, for myself as a consumer, my biggest question is what would happen if Microsoft does indeed buy it and is hoping to use it to wage a war against Google? Like, that just on a visceral level, that seems frightening to me. What would be the prospects there? But in the short term, I think, you know, beyond people whose jobs may be affected at Yahoo, I think there's a chance perhaps Yahoo will completely drown in the corporate maneuvering. But otherwise, I think it'll still be around but continue to play a smaller and smaller role.
Let's talk a little bit about Flickr, which is a photo sharing service, another one of these moments of inspiration that turned into a great business. Yahoo owns Flickr, and Getty Images, the largest photo distributor, announced a deal that it's going to begin licensing some of the photos on Flickr to its clients, who are newswires, newspapers, and magazines. Flickr says it has 54 million users and hosts about 2 billion photos. So, again, what does this really mean? What does it mean for a big photo entity that serves professional organizations to go to what has been an amateur hobbyist site?
It's definitely an intriguing development. I mean, in the short term, Getty says it'll be a very limited partnership. And I mean, I think in the short term, I don't think it'll have a huge impact on the lives of professional photographers. But as far as the precedent it sets, if I was a professional photographer, I would definitely be wondering what this means for my role. You know, as technology advances, it becomes easier and easier for amateurs to produce pretty good quality work in various forms of media. And, you know, if everyone can do well as an amateur, it raises the question of what is the future for professionals? And we've certainly seen that in the world of newspapers, especially, and other forms of old media. You know, they're feeling very threatened as far as their viability in this market where amateurs can do so much. And I think in the short term, the vast majority of photographs on Flickr are very low resolution. They were taken with, you know, cheaper consumer digital cameras. But in the long run, I'd definitely be wondering, you know, if someone like Getty Images can come to this vast pool of amateur photos, will the role of professional photographers be shrinking in the long run?
Does this mean someone's going to send me a check for my picture of my cousin?
I would think the odds are against that, but you never know. I mean, there's certainly various kinds of stock photography out there that people are looking for. And Getty says that they're looking to expand their reach in terms of photographs that have more local, regional relevance. So you never know. But in the short term, I think there'll be very few high-end users on Flickr that benefit. And I think if you're a professional photographer, the smartest thing for you to do is adapt your game to this new technology. You should have already been on Flickr and been able to benefit from this.
All right. One last thing. Do you think your YouTube viewing records are secret? Well, think again. Last week, a federal judge told YouTube to cough up its complete logs to Viacom. That's going to let copyright holders know who's watching what, when, and how often. Viacom owns, you know, so many different groups, Comedy Central, MTV, BET. It wants to see if The Daily Show, for example, is getting ripped, literally, online, and they're getting ripped off. So the Washington Post said the judge's ruling throws users to the wolves. What do you think?
It's definitely seems to be a disturbing precedent. I mean, Viacom says that it doesn't want to use the info to figure anything out about individual users. They just want to see what the aggregate shows about how much money they may be losing from people watching copyrighted content on YouTube. But who's to say that we can trust that once they have all this data that could tell us what each person is watching? You know, certainly you'd have to think they'll be tempted to use it. And as far as the precedent it sets, what happens when the next company wants to make a similar suit? They may not be as trustworthy about using it to figure things out about individuals. So, I mean, I think it does definitely set a dangerous precedent. But I think if you're online, realistically, you have to assume that there's a great deal of data being accumulated about everything you do, and you have to assume that your privacy always could be jeopardized. I think, you know, that's from a common sense standpoint, you had to assume this would happen sooner or later.
Just quickly, what should you do if so?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think there's an easy answer to that. Just be very aware that everything you're doing could be documented. I mean, there's ways you can do things from some other IP address other than your own. I mean, I think people think of it as something that only matters as far as people stealing copyrighted work, but there's many other ramifications. I mean, people all around the world use things like Google and YouTube, and there's been cases of government entities seeking to use data to go after political dissidents for what they're doing online. So
right.
I think it will definitely be important for people to figure out how to keep that anonymity.
Well, Jay, I want to thank you so much. And we were speaking with Jay Smooth, who video blogs at illdoctrine.com, and he joined us from our NPR studios in New York. NYPD Blue, Law and Order, ER. Those are just some of the shows that Paris Barclay has directed or produced. His current TV project is the HBO drama In Treatment.
I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but there was a moment when this old man came over to me. He kept looking at me with a strange little smile. Anna Brava. Which means I know you. In some deep, intuitive way, he knew I was the man who dropped the bomb that destroyed the whole street. And I looked in his eyes, sort of amused, kind of friendly. The way my father looks at me when he thinks I've done something wrong, like he knows my secrets.
You still think it's too early to talk about your father?
Let me tell you something. My father killed his father with his bare hands.
Now Barclay has returned to the stage with a new musical, One Red Flower. It was adapted from letters written by Vietnam soldiers and their loved ones. Barclay recently sat down with NPR's Tony Cox.
First of all, let me welcome you to News & Notes. Great to have you in studio with
us. It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Tony.
Man, your biography is just so eclectic. You have done things like Forever.
Yeah, you'd think I'd be exhausted, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would think that you would be exhausted. I don't even know where to begin, so I'm going to begin at the end, so to speak.
Ah.
The present, maybe that's a better way of putting it. Let's talk about this new project, One Red Flower. It's sort of an adaptation of an earlier work about the Vietnam War, is that right?
22 years ago, I'm in a bookstore in New York, and I see this book called Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam. And I'm thinking, I'm a musical writer, because that's what I was doing in New York at that time. I was writing musicals. They were being produced. And, you know, I had a little job in advertising. And I opened the book, and I was moved. I said, wow, these are real letters written by real soldiers during the Vietnam War. This would be a really interesting project. I went home, wrote the first song that night.
Really?
So for 22 years, I became a big director and producer and did all this television. I've always been doing this as my passion project. And this weekend, we're going to be showing it to people and raising money for a great organization.
What was it that inspired you? Because you didn't go to the war, did you?
No, I was too young, thank you.
Yeah, so what was the connection for you?
I think to me, when I first read it, at that time, 1986, Platoon hadn't been out, Born on the 4th of July, all those things that gave us different perspectives on the Vietnam War hadn't happened yet in the film world. So I just thought of the Vietnam vet the way a lot of people did, as someone who came back broken and was disrespected. This book showed their humanity. It showed their humor. It showed their home life and their longing for, you know, the true patriotism that they felt and not discovering it in Vietnam. And I thought, that no one's seen that.
This Vietnam is not my Vietnam. Although we fought side by side, look in the letters from our Vietnams. Look for the secrets we can't hide. Look for the secrets we can't hide. I was there,
pumping the boonies. I was there.
You have been involved in directing just a number of shows. You've won a couple of Emmys. And here's the question that I have. It goes back to as you were beginning to get involved in musicals and things of that sort and your encounter with Stephen Sondheim.
Well, I met Stephen way back in the 80s when I first actually, I think I first met him when I was at Harvard, when he came to do Pacific Overtures in Boston. It was trying out, and he came to speak at Harvard. And I didn't know from Stephen Sondheim growing up in Chicago, but as I got to Harvard, everyone's listening to Stephen Sondheim records and very sophisticated, so I had to get sophisticated too. And so I learned a little bit about his work, and I met him, and I was really impressed. And he, you know, basically taught me a lot about writing a musical. He came to the first musical I did that was produced, called On Hold with Music, and he gave me, I'd say, 4 pages of fairly brutal notes on what to do and what not to do.
Well, what I read sounded less than flattering. It said that you had talent, but that you should stick to the black folks' music. Did he really say that?
Well, he didn't say it exactly in those words. He just said, looking at the marketplace, you know, you're trying to write a musical like me. Why don't you write a musical that deals with black stories, because you are African-American, and that way you'll get it on much faster. And by the way, you'll be the finest African-American writer of musicals in history. So that's the way that he spun it, just in terms of just marketing. So I was a little hurt by it at first, but then I thought, this is not a bad idea.
I'm glad you straightened that out, because the reading of it online just made it sound like he just completely just threw you under the bus.
You know, I took it that way. I must say I was a little bit like, yo, what up? But then I thought about it and I said, I know what he's saying. He's saying, get out there first, get out there in front, do something that separates you in the marketplace. It'll get on. And he was right.
Now, I also understand in your days at Harvard, from reading, I don't know if this is true or not, so I need you to straighten it out for me.
It better be.
That Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court was a classmate of yours.
Well, he was a classmate of mine in high school and at Harvard.
John Roberts.
John Roberts, actually, when I was thinking about going to Harvard, he and I went to the same high school, a school called Lalamere School for Boys in LaPorte, Indiana, which was a private school. And he was already at Harvard, and I went and visited Harvard, and I stayed in his room, and he was just the most, you know, studious guy ever, because he was number one in his class all the time, always the best and the brightest. He didn't even have time to take me out to show me Harvard, because he was studying for some exam, so I had to do it on my own. And he was at Harvard all the time I was there. We rarely spoke, because I went to the theater, and he went right to the library. And I guess if you're going to be a Supreme Court justice, you better start early. I figured if I'm going to be in entertainment, I better start early, too. So our paths sort of diverged there.
Have you ever had any encounters with him since he's been on the high court?
You know, there's a lot I'd like to say to him, Tony, between you and I haven't had the opportunity to do that. I was questioned a lot when the nomination hearings were happening. I got a lot of news reporters who found that little fact and would call me up. And I must say I was very judicious.
I wish I could show your expression on radio. Radio just doesn't do what television does sometimes. I don't even know what to call this necessarily. And when I saw that you were involved in this, had been involved in this project, I was like, man, this guy does all kinds of stuff.
I can't be stopped.
Don't be a menace to society while drinking your juice in the hood.
Yes.
The Wayans Brothers comic, I'm not sure what to call
masterpiece.
It.
Masterpiece.
Yeah, you directed
I used the word
that.
Masterpiece. Yes, I was the director of that movie.
Yo, I'm finished to tell you how it is in the hood. See, because in the hood, everybody's a target. Nah, I ain't like that. I'm going to tell you the real deal what it goes on in the hood. See, in the hood, most of us won't reach the age of 21.
Happy birthday, homie.
For me?
Yeah. Happy birthday, homeboy.
For me?
Yeah. Make a wish.
I got offered this picture and I agreed to do it. It probably wasn't the best first movie for me because I'm much more, how shall I say it nicely, serious.
I was shocked and amazed, shocked and awed, as the president might say.
It is a classic in the homeboy posse group.
It
I mean, there are, I meet people constantly who've seen it 13 times and know every line right now.
Here's my last thing. Given that you've really been very vocal about your homosexuality and you've been an advocate and all of those things, with the law that recently changed in California, did you get married?
I'm about to get married. I have to stop working for a minute. But probably August or September, we've already gotten the marriage license, which was exciting. The fact that this state says it's okay. If you love somebody, it's okay. It's not going to ruin my marriage. If you get married, it's just going to make you happier. Felt really good. So we will be getting married. What we want to do is figure out a time when we can do it, when we can not have presents and stuff like that, but make it yet again another benefit, because, you know, I love to do these benefits. Make it a benefit to benefit some organization that will help get marriage equality for everyone.
Whether you're gay or straight, getting married is a big step. Are you concerned about it?
Not at all, actually. I've been with the same person for almost 10 years, so now I know, you know, what it feels like to be an old married person, and it's kind of okay. I'm kind of ready to settle down. I'm ready to bring these kids up, and eventually they'll probably have to go to the Lallemere School like John Roberts and I. I'll have to move back to Chicago, and that's all good. I'm happy about that, so it's cool.
Great. Paris Barkley, thank you, man.
Very thank
much.
You, Tony.
And congratulations. Best of wishes on your getting married.
Okay,
we'll talk after
you
do it.
All right. You think it'll change then?
Everything changes after marriage.
Director, playwright, and composer Paris Barkley. His new musical, inspired by Vietnam veterans' letters, is called One Red Flower. And he spoke with NPR's Tony Cox.
I don't understand this war.
Look, man, it don't mean nothing.
Am I fighting for the flag? Do I get one if we win? To wear across my body bag.
Hey, calm down, Barry.
Notes, Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsiabwadi produce News and Notes, Sasha Woodruff edits, and Kenya Young and Devin Robbins are our directors. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Carlos Asensio is our drive engineer. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Jeffrey Bennett, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Gardner, Ernest Champel, Nora Codd, and Zachary Slowbig. Our interns are Ashley Lisney and Blake Bishton. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. On Monday, we'll have the latest in economic news plus our bloggers' roundtable. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.